Okay. I do believe we're ready to begin. We're at full strength. We will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Stand, and it'll be brought to us by Shelby Anguiano.
Good evening, Commissioners. Let me take the roll call. Commissioner Hurd?
Present.
Commissioner Hartwig?
Present.
Commissioner Pitts?
Present.
Chair Main?
Here.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Here.
Commissioner Castillo?
Present.
Commissioner Negrage?
Present.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you. I want to recognize with the new members to the team, Ms. Anguiano, you have been officially broken in. We do that, especially when you're talking, and we can bust you. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I was getting Greer, but I was getting her through you. Again. Okay, how about approval of the minutes? Everybody's had a chance to read them, I know. It was a nice short meeting the last time. Four people were here. So one of the four needs to say, I liked it. I'll move it.
I'll move to approve.
I'll second that.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded. Any questions on the agenda? I mean, on the minutes? Hearing none. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
To approving it. All those opposed, say no. Any abstentions? It's unanimously carried. Thank you. Modifications to the agenda? Hearing none. Moving right along to the reports from legal counsel? Hearing none.
There are no final decisions made in closed session, Commissioners.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on to new business. We have a public hearing.
Good evening, Commissioners. Today we have a public hearing on our fiscal year 2013 MTW plan. This is takes the place of the annual plan for the Housing Authority. And this year we do have some interesting changes to how we want to pilot a couple of rent simplification projects. We have, by the way, met with our legal advocates. We invited them down early last week and talked it through. If they have any comments, they'll get it to us in writing before the due date. We did meet with our RAB as well. We're going to go back and meet with them one more time at the end of next week, so we give them plenty of time to read it and get us any comments. Having said that, I thought it'd be worthwhile to have Anna Gwen walk us through a PowerPoint she's prepared that'll help answer some questions. Then we can take some questions and answers afterwards, and then open the public hearing if that's acceptable.
Okay, Ms. Anna Gwen Simpson.
Yes. Good evening, Commissioners. Okay, so we have a presentation of our fiscal year 2013 MTW plan, and you should have a copy of the presentation in front of you as well. So just a quick overview of MTW, just to remind everybody. So MTW stands for Moving to Work. It's a demonstration program of HUD. OHA, we call it Making Transitions Work. We are one of 33 agencies with MTW authority from HUD out of about 3,500 public housing agencies nationwide. Our agreement is through fiscal year 2018, and this current plan is for our upcoming fiscal year, which starts July 1, 2012 and goes through June 30, 2013. So the primary statutory objectives for the MTW program are to increase housing choices for low-income families, to provide incentives for families with children to become economically self-sufficient, and to reduce costs and achieve greater cost effectiveness. So just an overview of our housing stock portfolio for the upcoming fiscal year. You can see the breakdown of our public housing, our MTW vouchers, our non-MTW vouchers, which are our special purpose vouchers like the Mainstream program Mod Rehab and VASH, which is Veteran Affairs Supportive Housing Vouchers, and then Shelter Plus Care that we administer for the County of Alameda, for a total of 15,188 households served. And you can see there's a little pie chart to show you the breakdown. The majority of the stock is in our MTW vouchers. And these are just a couple maps to give a description of where our sites are. This first map is our public housing and our OP sites, which are the former public housing scattered sites that were disposed of that are now project-based vouchered units. And then this is a map of Section 8 vouchers in use at the end of fiscal year 11, so June 30th, 2011. So for this upcoming fiscal year, our primary goal is going to be promoting resident empowerment, self-sufficiency, and educational achievement. And we are proposing a new activity this year, which is our rent reform pilot program. So rent reform to HUD means basically any change to the way that rent is calculated in the Section 8 and public housing programs. And MTW agencies are required to implement a rent reform policy that encourages self-sufficiency. So we have decided to do this as a pilot program. So we're going to roll it out in a couple of sites first to see how it's working before we try and take on the larger program as a whole. So what we've done is we've identified two different groups as well as two different pilot sites. So the groups, we've broken households into two groups, senior and disabled households and what we're calling work-eligible households. So the senior and disabled households are basically households where the head, spouse, or co-head of the household is 62 years or older, there's a person with disabilities that's the head, co-head, or spouse of a head of household. Those definitions are consistent with HUD's, the current regulations regarding the definition behind senior and person with disabilities. We're using HUD's definition of a person with disabilities. As far as the work-eligible households, it's essentially all the households that don't meet that criteria. So it's all the other households. So if you're not senior or disabled based on these definitions, then you're in the other group, which is our work-eligible households. And these can include households that are non-senior, non-disabled households that could be on a fixed income or have no income. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're currently employed. They're just work-eligible. And then we've also chosen two pilot sites, one for each of our primary programs. So in the public housing program, we've chosen Campbell Village, which is a 154-unit family building. It's got a mix of households. And 40% are senior and disabled households, and 60% would fall into our work-eligible household category. And for the Section 8 program, we've chosen AMP 10, which is a grouping of properties in East Oakland that's approximately 280 units. And 27% are senior and disabled households, and 73% are work-eligible households. And we chose those specific sites because they were representative of the program as a whole. So Campbell Village is representative, both social and economic demographics in comparison to public housing as a larger group, as the entire program. And same with AMP 10. It's very representative of particularly the OP sites that were the former public housing sites, but also Section 8 as a whole. There are a lot of comparisons to that population. So we felt that they were a good kind of model to test out these ideas to really give us a feel for how it's going to work with these households. We are excluding FSS participants. So if a family is already enrolled in the FSS program, then they will stay in the FSS program and have their rents calculated according to those rules. And the other exclusion is the MOMS program, which happens to be in AMP 10. It's a very specialized program. It's the program where we provide housing for women who are reuniting with their children who are ex-offenders. So we want to keep that as a separate program as well. So those participants are excluded from this pilot. So the components of our rent reform program. So what we really wanted to do was try and simplify the way rent is calculated. Currently, the way rent is calculated, it's sort of a complex formula that's used. It's often confusing to tenants. It sometimes doesn't get calculated correctly, and it requires a lot of information from our tenants, and we feel there's a level of intrusion there in terms of information that we have to get from the tenants that really otherwise it's not really our business to know necessarily all that information about them. So one of the things we looked at was trying to come up with a way to simplify it, and the way we want to do that is by eliminating our deductions. So what we're going to do is we're going to take gross annual income, and we're looking at doing a flat percentage of the gross annual income. So it's still an income-based model. We're not changing that, but we are lowering the percentage that we're charging of the income in exchange for eliminating the deductions. And I have some more slides sort of getting into more details about that. But what we found in the analysis was that by lowering that percentage, typically it's 30%. Right now, annual income, you have your gross annual income, then there's deductions from the income, you come up with an adjusted annual income, and then we multiply that by 30%, and that's your monthly rent payment. Under this new model, we've lowered the percentage, and in the analysis, we found that that, for the most part, compensates for those deductions, the average deductions that most households were getting. So in addition to the lowering the percentage, we're also changing the recertification schedule for seniors and disabled households. It's going to be a triennial recertification schedule with an annual cost of living adjustment based on Social Security's cost of living, whether it goes up or down, the rent will automatically be adjusted accordingly. Typically, this is a small percentage. Usually, it's 1 or 2% that it's adjusted either up or down. For the work-eligible households, we're going to move to a biennial recertification, which means they'll be recertified every other year. And the main thing we wanted to accomplish with these two populations is for the senior and disabled households, we wanted to create a system that was going to be simpler but also consistent and predictable, something that they should know what their rent is going to be. It should be fairly consistent and easy to understand and not require them to come in constantly with a lot of paperwork to basically end up at the same place they were the year before. For the work-eligible households, we really wanted to create a system that was going to remove some of the disincentives to work and increase earnings and really give households a chance to save up some of their earnings over time to hopefully help them get to a place of self-sufficiency where they can move on. So this box below are things that are going to apply to all households, so the deductions are being eliminated. The earned income disallowance is being eliminated. That's a specific component that is sort of complicated, and we feel that we have this next one, the recent income disregard at recertification, is kind of something we're doing in place of the earned income disregard. And what that means is that if your income has increased within 6 months of your recertification, so 6 months right before you get your recertification, if your income goes up, you get a promotion, we're not going to count that increase in your income towards your rent payment. So that's going to be excluded from your annual income, so it's not going to count towards how we're calculating your rent, which potentially could give a household up to 30 months, 2 years plus that 6 months, to basically hold on to that little extra increase, budget their money, and kind of plan and prepare themselves, too, for the eventual rent increase that will happen at the next recertification. But it does give them a chance to save up some of that money for themselves. Additionally, income from assets less than $50,000 will be excluded. That's a current OHA policy, so that's not changing. What we are changing is that at recertification, households will just need to sign a self-certification that information is still accurate. So they will need to provide the information on the front end, but when it comes to recertification, it will simply be a self-certification, so they aren't going to need to justify that they have less than $50,000 in assets and bring in all the paperwork to document that. And finally, we are going to institute an absolute minimum rent of $25, which means that every household will have to pay at least $25 towards their rent. Right now, what happens is the total tenant payment, which is the TTP, is determined. Then there's a utility allowance. And in certain cases, the total tenant payment minus the utility allowance, that equals what the tenant ends up paying in rent. And in some cases, that can be less than what the current minimum rent is. And we want to set that so that they're always paying at least $25. So that's a change that we're doing.
I just want to interject one thing about that change as it relates to the President's proposed fiscal year 2013 budget. As part of the Appropriation Act, is proposing to raise the minimum rent to $50 and then $75. We had a conversation with our MTW. We had our site visit in February, and we brought up, can we exempt ourselves and keep 25 as our rent initiative? At that point, our MTW person was going to try and get us an answer, but she thought if it comes through the appropriations bill, then we don't have the ability to exempt that act. But I was in D.C. on Thursday and Friday, and I was able to have a conversation with the MTW head, Ivan Poor, and he thinks that it's depending on the wording of the bill that it may still be okay. And that means that if the bill reads to amend the Act of 1937 to X, Y, and Z, then it becomes included in the Act and we would be able to do it. So once, if the President's proposal to increase the minimum rents to $50 and $75 stays in the appropriations bill when it's passed, then they would look at how the wording introducing that. And if the introduction is to amend the Act, then we would be able to still keep with our $25 instead of going up to $50 or $75.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reasoning behind that was really that we wanted that we want to provide a way for work-eligible households to be more economically self-sufficient. So we did intentionally want to give them a little bit more of a break in hopes that they have the chance to save up money and become economically self-sufficient. We also feel that households, you know, that are in that work-eligible population with children, a lot of them have children, we want to basically give them the benefit of that little extra income in hopes that they can get themselves back on their feet and get to where they want to get to in their life. So, and with...
So once somebody hits 62, you say, nah, you got it now.
Well, I wouldn't say it quite like that. Okay. Okay, so this is an impact analysis that we did to determine what will be the impacts or what are the anticipated impacts on our households. So at the top, you can see there's two boxes, the blue and the purple one, that kind of show the average tenant rent payment. The one on the left is for the senior and disabled households. The one on the right is for work-eligible households. The difference in the what they're paying in rent has to do with the incomes of the people in those units and in those properties. So that's why there is a different rent payment, but those are the averages. And as you can see, on average, the tenant rents should go down for both populations, a small amount. So for the senior and disabled households, in terms of changes in the rent payment, 86% of the households will either see a decrease in their rent payment or their rent will have no change. The other percentage, the 14%, will see an increase, but 10% of those will have less than a 25% increase, and the 4% will have 25 or more. So the majority of the people seeing an increase, it'll be $25 or less. Yes.
Next question on this slide. Mm-hmm. So looking at AMP 10 before 283, after 266.
Right.
So I was trying to think yesterday, so the balance is $17 per unit times the number of units times 12 months. So there's an annual decrease.
Yes.
So what goes to fill in that gap?
It gets to how we're funded in both. I mean, there are two programs here. AMP 10 is project-based Section 8. Campbell Village is public housing. What we're talking about is the tenant portion of the rent.
Right.
So the rest of it would be HAP, the assistance payment. Now, we get a certain amount of HAP that we usually don't expend, which is kind of the excess money that we have to use under MTW. Even if we were not an MTW agency, then HUD would fund that through the HAP, so we're actually using more of HUD's money to subsidize the rent. Because we're MTW, that extra $16 or whatever the difference is on the Section 8 side is HAP we could use for something else. But we think it's a fairly decent exchange for us being able to cut our administrative costs. One of the things that we want to know as quickly as we can, whether or not this is really effective and we can roll it out, has to do with what's going to be, I think, a continued 75% allocation of Section 8 administrative fees. So they've cut us by a quarter on our administrative side to do this every year, and we've got to find some economies in order to live within that budget. Section 8 program is taking over even the recertifications and work of eligibility for the public housing side as we get closer to having one program. Campbell Village is public housing. Public housing is funded similarly, but there's a lag time. And without getting too detailed, this year, they say this is the project expense level. Say it's $450 per unit per month. That's regardless of what the tenant pays, regardless of what the HUD subsidy pays, that's the amount. So it just falls within that PEL period. So there's the loss of income, tenant revenue, will impact the public housing program, but every year or two it'll catch up. So if you have a tenant increase income on your development, say your overall tenant receipts go up, you know, X number of dollars, in 2 years when they do the calculation, they're going to account for that and give you less subsidy. So in 2 years we will have become flat with HUD is what I'm saying, because this cut in tenant revenue that we're taking in this year will eat it, next year will be the transition year, and then the following year we'll get the subsidy level to the PEL. Okay. All right. I hope I answered that. It's very, because we're MTW, it's a little more confusing, and the way they fund these programs is a little bit different, and that's why we're trying one project-based Section 8 portfolio and one public housing. The big goal of this is to track the costs and make sure that we, how we break even over the time and how much money we save in terms of annual recertifications.
Yeah, no, I was heartened that there's going to be, for the majority of residents, there's a decrease in impact, and mm-hmm. for some, there's a modest increase. Mm-hmm. But then I became concerned on the property side that we're not setting our properties up for less revenue coming.
And you know, we could, if that became an issue, if we weren't MTW, it would cost HUD more. Because we're MTW, we're using some of our MTW money that we could use for other purposes to help implement this. But what we're looking for on the other side is to have it cost us less in terms of administering the program and also be less intrusive to our residents so that we don't have to demand they come in every 12 months with it's like filing tax return every 12 months. It's very arduous.
Before you go on, if I can make a quick clarification, you mentioned that some funds that we have coming in would our excess, I'm sure you want to rephrase that because some people have a tendency to believe that it's more than what we need when you say excess.
Yeah, what happens with the difference between us and a normal agency is we don't have year-end reconciliation of our money, that we turn money back to HUD. So that normally at the end of the year we would turn money back to HUD under the Section 8 program, but we don't go through that. HUD holds on to it until we have a use for it, however, and this is a use for it, so we'll draw it down. So it isn't really excess. They're now holding on to those funds.
Thank you. Mr. Hartwig.
Well, this was the same question I had on this that I emailed in. And but now I'm finding that this is actually a little more complicated than because it has a cost side to this as well. Have you guys done an economic analysis of this that mm-hmm. we could see? I mean that would have projected over time, here is the revenue hit we expect to take, but here is the cost improvement we expect to take, and then net-net, here's either the positive or the negative, and then just so we understand the mm-hmm. rationale, because if we are taking money away from something else to do this, we just at least want to know what we're doing, you know, mm-hmm. so that we know what the other thing is
are.
That we're not doing to be able to do this thing.
So, mm-hmm. so and what will be the long-term savings? We have done some of that. Keep in mind, this is based on the current population. A couple of the unknowns are the number of times a tenant might come in and request an interim, mm-hmm. in terms of factoring cost savings of how many staff it takes to do annual recertifications for the sites. When you go to once every 3 years for the senior sites and once every 2 years for the family sites, you really start seeing savings. You see them out a year or two because you have to schedule that out. And what we're looking at is trying to get administratively more efficient so we can live within what HUD's going to give us down the road, but also at not a great cost. And I think, Anna Gwen, I don't know if you have slides down the road about some of the analysis in terms of the benefits and deductions, the medical benefits, for example, how many people currently take advantage and what the costs are by
yeah.
eliminating those. And so we'll get. Let's let her get through the presentation. And see
well,
where
I just
we
like
are.
To. I just what I'm really suggesting is that we see an economic analysis of this, so that we really understand what the impacts mm-hmm. are this year and out into the future. So that we're at least making decisions with our eyes.
And to the extent that we can do that now, and part of the pilot study of taking the two sites is to get that in real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can project and we can tell you this is what we think it's going to be, But what we want to do is pilot it at two different areas so we can determine whether or not we, how much it really does cost us, how much it really does
cost us.
So no, she has the projections, but the projections are only projections.
I understand. Normally, the way I've seen this sort of thing done in the past is that even before the pilot, it's like, okay, we have a plan, and we think this is right. Now we're going to do the pilot, and we're going to vet the assumptions. Oh, this was right, this was wrong, and now here we're going to do the real. So that there's planning discipline right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Because, you know, part of the thing is we just want to know that that kind of discipline is actually in place and happening. And we want to see what the analysis is as well.
And part of the analysis is picking the control groups. So we have, for the project in Section 8, we have AMP 9, so we have a control group. For Campbell Village, we're going to take 154 units that we're going to choose in Peralta Village next door that match the same bedroom size.
Right.
And we'll track the cost of both and how it works. So go on, though.
Well, one final question. What percent of residents are paying the minimum $25 rent?
Currently?
Yeah.
I don't know off the top of my head. I can definitely get you that information. I can tell you at Campbell Village, I think all of the tenants were paying $25 or more. At AMP 10, it was a little different, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but there were some people who were paying less than $25 there.
But I'm just wondering how many are actually at that $25 minimum and how many are lower. I'm just curious how many people get affected when we start moving the program, and I'm also just curious to know how many people are at that rent. I mean, that's a low rent.
I mean, right, wow. Yes. Yeah. Well, and keep in mind, too, that in your annual income, there's also exclusions from your income. There's allowable exclusions. For example, if you have a student who's over 18, full-time student income, that's excluded. You know, so there's some income that's, and we're not changing that. So those people will still have excluded income. But I do want to say that some of the impact analysis that's been done is in the plan in the appendix, which I think you guys all have a copy of the plan in front of you. The appendix starts on page 46, and there's four tables that at least speak to, they don't speak to everything you're talking about, but they do show basically the details to this summary I'm showing you on my slide here, but the details about who had what kinds of deductions, who was using certain types of, you know, which people had deductions. So essentially, who is this going to impact? So some of that is in the back, too.
I mean, essentially, if it helps, I'm really looking at this as a project. And so what I'm really talking about is project analysis.
Mm-hmm.
This is really what it is.
Yeah.
Hey.
Okay.
Ms. Hurd.
I had a question regarding the child care.
Uh-huh.
It's very expensive, and is there a cap on the child care? Because a lot of people are paying a lot of money for child care.
Yeah, so there is a hardship policy that goes along with this. I just haven't gotten to it yet, but there is a hardship policy for people with excessive either medical expenses or child care expenses or lots of dependents.
You know what's interesting about that, Commissioner Harbour, is if you look on page 47 of the plan, you go to the child care expenses of the current people who are claiming them. I don't think we have anybody claiming those at either of these sites.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting thing, too. So
they're not using them because they're so hard to use.
The documentation required. A lot of people don't take advantage of it.
Really?
So I was surprised when I did the analysis because some of the things that I thought would be big issues, either residents really aren't taking advantages of those things. So hopefully, under this system, they actually would get more of an advantage because for whatever reason, they're not providing the information to us to get that deduction. So at least this way, they'll get some deduction.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I think we finished this slide, but there's like I said, there's a lot more details in the appendix that break this all down. I just wanted to give kind of a visual and basically make the point that we expect most of the households to see either a decrease or a minimum or no change in their rent. So here's a calculation example. I did a couple of these so that we could kind of see how this breaks down it just in a really simple way. So this would be a single senior disabled individual who's on a fixed income, getting their income from Social Security. It's assuming a monthly income of $874 a month. So here I've assumed that they're getting the elderly disabled deduction, which is $400. If you're elderly or disabled, you only get it one time. This person has no dependents, so they wouldn't have gotten dependent deductions. I'm assuming annual medical expenses of $100, annual disability expenses of $100, no child care expenses. And I think, too, keep in mind that the medical expenses, you don't get 100% of your medical expenses reimbursed. It's as a deduction. It's a percentage of your medical expenses that you get counted as a deduction. So from this, you would take the gross, you'd subtract out the deductions, and then you get your adjusted annual income. You divide that by 12 to get your monthly income. And then when you multiply that by 30%, under the old calculation, this person would have been paying $247. Under the new calculation, there's no deduction, so the adjusted annual income is the same as the gross annual income. So when you multiply that monthly amount by 27.5, their new rent would be $240. So in this scenario, this person would be paying $7 less a month.
And
in
so
rent.
We would have $7 of, and currently we would be using $7 more of MTW funds to fund the HAP. Post-MTW, HUD would be paying $7 more.
Right.
That we wouldn't be returning $7 more to HUD.
HUD would, wait a minute, you mean if, wait a minute, you mean we could change the rents around so that we could lower them even more and HUD would pay more? That can't be possible.
That's sort of what we're proposing here a little bit. We're lowering the rents, and that's why HUD has to approve the plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay, so they have to sign up to it.
All right. Okay, so... This next example is a single working adult with two children, assuming that they have wages, that they have an earned income. So dependent deduction, you get $480 per dependent. So this assumes two children and $100 annual child care expense. And so under the old calculation, this person would have been paying $290 in rent. And under the new calculation, this person would pay $285 in rent. So again, it's $5 less a month. And this is really just to give you, just to show you kind of how the calculations work in a simple way, so it makes sense, hopefully. So our hardship policy, you'd asked about this. So what we're proposing is that if a household has more than $25 increase in their tenant rent payment and they have three or more dependents, out-of-pocket child care expenses above $2,000 annually, or out-of-pocket medical expenses above $1,500 annually, then the rent increase would be capped at $25 monthly. If a household feels that that doesn't meet their needs, that they have additional hardship, that they still can't make it work, or they don't meet those requirements and they feel like it's an undue burden on them, they can request a hardship review, and we will have a committee that will review those hardship cases on a case-by-case basis. In order to request the hardship review, they are going to have to provide all of the information that they would under the old calculations to justify that they have those needs that they're requesting to be considered. And this is, if the hardship policy is applied to that household, it would last for a year, and then they'd have to come back and go through it again until they get to a point where either they don't have a hardship or, you know, we can put them back on the regular plan. So they will have to come in annually.
Well, the thinking behind, so the hardship being a dollar amount as opposed to a percentage of rent, so, you know, an increase by $25 for someone who pays $25 is doubling the impact of rent, but someone who's already paying like $200 to increase
right.
by 25,
right.
and yet you could argue the first person is burdened much more than the second person.
That's
Did you
a good
think
point.
About a percentage, or what was the reason for a...
We did not think about a percentage. I can tell you that 100% of the households that had more than $25 increase will qualify under this hardship policy. So that was one of the considerations, was kind of looking at who were the people that were overly burdened who had an excessive increase. But I think your point is it's a very good point about if your rent's $25 and it goes up $25. I can tell you, though, because I looked at all the information, I think that's very unlikely to occur. But convincing you of that, I don't have the information to convince you of that. But I know because I did the analysis. But I think that is a good point, and I will look into that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Basing it on a percentage mm-hmm. in a year instead of 25. We did our disposition application. We had, I believe, what 30? What was it? 50. Yeah, that anyone who in Section 8 was paying our flat rent as opposed to what they would be calculated under the Section 8 program, which would be higher than flat rent. We're only increasing at no more than $50 per year until they get to that. But it was really only impacted the people at the highest income level. And I think that's what anyone's trying to point out, is you wouldn't get an increase on a lower level based on this calculation. But we'd have to look at that, and we should.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I forgot to mention this earlier, but the flat rent option for public housing is still going to be available. So households that are currently choosing a flat rent option can still choose a flat rent option. So the part of the impact analysis I did does not exclude those households that are currently on a flat rent. So some of those people are the increases, and those are people that are basically, if you were to calculate their rent based on their income, they would be paying more than the flat rent. So some of those households are in there. So some of the households that I've identified are not, may not necessarily see an increase because they may choose the flat rent option. So just want to make that point. Okay. So moving on from rent reform, and you're welcome to ask more questions if you think of any, but we do have 21 ongoing MTW activities that we're going to be continuing this year. And we just have a quick list here, but I also did want to bring to your attention on page 32 is our 07-01, which is our triennial income recertification. So this activity is the triennial recertifications for elderly and disabled households on fixed incomes is something we've been doing in our Section 8 program and at a couple of our public housing sites. So it has been successful. And if you looked at our last report, too, which is on our website, there's some more information about kind of the cost savings we feel we've realized as a result of that activity. So part of, at least for that population and choosing that, it's been a model that's been really successful for us. So that's part of where that came out of. And our budget for fiscal year 2013, it's in the plan in detail, but just a snapshot here just to show you kind of the breakdown of funding. As you know, the majority of our funding comes from our Housing Choice Voucher Program, and you can see kind of how it breaks out in terms of the sources and uses there in the pie charts. And that is the presentation.
Ms. Castillo.
Once again, you guys have amazed me and just floored me with the way that you thought this out, that balances the assets of the Oakland Housing Authority against taking care of our residents. I mean, I was one of the folks that every time my income went up, my rent went up every single year. And it was disheartening, and it really felt like I wasn't getting anywhere for a long time. And this process goes so far to help that. And when we first started talking about helping people get back to work, I like really freaked out. Because if you do that in Alameda County or at the city level, they mean forcing people with undue hardships to when they're not ready for work and they don't have the skills to work or there's so many barriers to work, and yet they're imposing stuff like that in order to for them to keep the little money that they have or the service that they have. And we didn't do that. And I'm just so proud of this agency that if this is the way that the city should run and the county should run. And so I'm very, very pleased and very, very happy that we're also considering the savings that I see that's going to happen and the workload that is going to be decreased on our staff as far as implementing this. I ask that you please email me the slides on page 3 because they're so little and I'd love to really see them.
Sure.
And the other thing is I would like to know whether the inspections will occur regularly because that's actually the piece that we should kind of stay regular on because some of our people need that support. Okay, but thank you. I applaud you. Standing
we'll look ovation. At inspections. Thank you. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to let you know is, and Anna Gwen can send, we'll send out the slides. Anything else you think of between now and, the next meeting, please email us back. Inspections are one thing I haven't thought through. We currently do the risk-based inspection upon renewal and how that impacts these two. We can talk about that maybe tomorrow. I think that HUD likes our risk-based inspection protocols, because it's another way to, where the landlords are really taking care of the units and they pass every single year and there's not an issue, to go back and put resources into that really doesn't get HUD anything, it doesn't get us anything, and it certainly doesn't get the resident anything. But to put the inspectors back into the field in 6 months if they failed, that gets the residents a better quality of housing. So it's a better direction of our resources. So we'll look at how that would impact, particularly if we go wider. Michelle, I think it could be a real issue. So mm-hmm. for these control groups, I don't think it's so much an issue, but I think for when we go to the tenant-based program, if we were to go wider, it really will be an issue.
So just for clarification, just to point out the inspection piece, because I think there are some issues in some of our units and public housing units where we need to be in there more. So mm-hmm. what you're saying is that if there is a situation where we find that there is circumstances in the unit that needs our attention, that we will be in there more.
What we're talking about is the difference between the HQS inspection for the tenant-based voucher versus just managing the property and inspecting your own units.
Mm-hmm.
Since
and
we
also
manage
the Section
both
8
these,
program.
We just inspect when we inspect, and we can do that internally.
Okay.
Where it becomes more problematic is when it's a private landlord.
Yeah,
and that's the HQS risk-based inspection for the Section 8 voucher, and that's what I think we really have to talk about.
Okay.
And come back with something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other comments, questions?
I had a question on page 35.
Uh-huh.
So this is table 9, FY 2013 plan sources and uses. Could you, there's a lot of negatives. There's a lot of parentheses. Can you just kind of walk through that table?
Table 9, are you talking about the deficit in public housing and the deficit in real estate development?
Yeah. that little thing.
The deficit in public housing, when we book this table, we book it based on the income provided that program. And right now it's budgeted a deficit $3.1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason we have submitted an application to HUD for the 383 units of senior site disposition is that's $1.2 million of that deficit every year is caused by those properties.
Mm-hmm.
HUD gives us such a reduced amount in the public housing program to manage the properties. Public housing, I think, for everyone, certainly for my entire career, has always operated at a deficit that had to be covered with other income. So what we do is we use MTW money, which you get over to the right-hand side and says MTW consolidated. They roll into one pot. What we do is really take MTW money and balance that deficit, because we pay our sites that are public housing at the same level we pay our project-based Section 8 sites. So we have made a decision over several years to fund them at a level in which they can be managed. And what that has resulted in is improvements to the units and being managed correctly. So that's where this is what it actually would cost us. If we were not MTW and couldn't move the money, we would have to balance and make $3 million worth of cuts, and those would probably be all of the capital improvements that we're doing to different sites throughout the city. Because we can do that, we move it. So that's really a booking against the HUD source of money, mm-hmm. which is public housing. Real estate development, when you see the $14 million deficit, that's really our investments in real estate, Fund 1 and Fund 2. That's what's left of them. Those come out of operating reserves that we have allocated for this. So we have reserve levels. $10 million is Fund 2. $4.7 million is what's left of Fund 1. So those get held, and they show as a deficit on our consolidated budget to HUD, but they're actually expending some of our reserves that you guys have obligated toward development activities that has not been written and paid out yet. The local programs, are actually run as we fund out of MTW just like we do public housing. The local programs are, for example, the 110 units of sponsor base mm-hmm. that we use. That's a local program. It's not a HUD Section 8 reimbursable program, so it books as a deficit, but we use MTW money to cover it. Does that make
mm-hmm.
okay?
So if the MTW money is going to fund, it seems like it's going to plug some of the shortfalls.
It funds all the shortfalls. To look at the budget in a different way, in a non-HUD table way, which we will this spring, if you see that the overall agency deficit based on this table is $12 million, and you realize $14.5 million is coming out of reserves that we have already obligated, then we actually are having a $2 million positive cash flow.
Okay.
Okay.
Commissioner Hartwig.
Yes. I had a couple other questions that I still want to get some answers that I want to try. These are really just clarification questions. But on page 21, activity number 1005, what does this mean about landlords accepting a lower half payment? I just didn't understand what that was.
This was, I believe we started, this is the disposition.
From disposition.
This came out of our disposition. We have a lot of what we call overhoused families.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're families who originally qualified for a three-bedroom because they had kids. The kids have grown up and moved out. So we allow the landlord, meaning in this case us, but another landlord, to accept the lower HAP payment for the unit, charge it as though it's a two-bedroom, instead of having the person move. And this was something we realized we were still going to benefit so much through moving it from public housing to Section 8 that we could afford for the in-place families to keep them in their current
units.
I see.
So we backfill that's what I wasn't sure, because I thought, no, what landlord
we just don't
would
have,
take lower?
And we just don't have the two bedrooms and one bedrooms in our portfolio. So we've got people sitting in three bedrooms, and that's the only place we have for them to live. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't negatively impact people. So this was one of the initiatives. We got approval from HUD that said we can do that for as long as we choose.
Oh, I see. Okay, it's just the terminology there. I just couldn't quite comprehend it.
Luckily, we have Anna Gwen who can translate HUDies better than anybody.
And we do have a glossary that I didn't make it into the draft,
into
the final.
Yes, yes, because I, you know, my feeble brain starts losing track of these acronyms after a while. Even if I looked it up and knew it a couple of minutes ago, I may be going through and then forget the acronym. Okay, so then the next question was, what does competitive bidding mean regarding project-based vouchers?
Right now, we piggyback, basically, on the city's competitive NOFA process for awarding project-based Section 8 to development, similar to
what
we just did.
Oh, I see.
Now, without redevelopment, if the city doesn't issue a NOFA, we're going to have to do our own RFPs. But what it's looking at is, how do we competitively award? What our exemption is to say we don't have to go out and competitively award ourselves.
Right.
Other agencies, non-MTW, don't have this permission. Even if we were going to award it to Tassa Faronga or to Lion Creek Crossing, would have to issue an RFP and award themselves the vouchers.
Mm-hmm.
It's an administrative process that garners a lot of work for everybody and often a lot of controversy without really benefiting anybody. And what HUD says is we don't, as MTW, have to do that. If we're involved in the deal, if we own the land and we're one of the partners, we can award ourselves the vouchers without going through a competitive process.
So then normally what the competitive process would be, let's say, five developers in Oakland were doing some type of low-income development, and they all wanted project-based vouchers, then we might say, well, we'll put that to a competitive bid, and we'll award X number of vouchers. I mean, is that how it would work?
Sort of. This is for when we award ourselves vouchers. So if we were to get disposition and we wanted to project-based vouchers like we did onto those units, we would have had to issue a NOFA, making the opportunity to award up to 1,554 project-based vouchers to people, and other agencies could apply and compete with us. We would turn in an application to ourselves, which would be evaluated, I'm sure, fairly and objectively. After the evaluation, we'd recommend to the board who to award the vouchers to. And I've done this, so I have to tell you, it's one of the most surreal conversations you have. And it takes money to issue an RFP, evaluate it, and take something to the board.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to make your partners angry because you're giving yourself vouchers and they don't. You write the NOFA in a way to preserve affordable housing units of 3 to 4 bedroom size located in small jurisdictions. You know, so you're writing it in a way that you're going to award what you want to award, and it just never worked. And it's an old HUD regulation. They've given us exclusion from having to do it.
I see. So I see. So the normally, if we weren't MTW, we would have to go through this really goofy process.
Yes.
Yeah.
So now, if we want to award vouchers to something that, say, it's a city project or something like that, because we've done some awarding of vouchers to kind of help something out of a mess or something like that. That's not.
We've done it under
two.
There's only
property.
Two conditions we do it. We do it if we have some vested ownership interest in the partnership, so we've helped create it, or the city has awarded through their competitive process funding. So the awards you get that we've done are ones the city has already awarded. So when we got, for example, the California Hotel, they got an award of money through the city's housing department.
I see.
What that allows Oakland to do is be really well positioned without a lot of work from on the developer side, because the nonprofits don't have to apply twice. Mm-hmm. And it allows them to go into any process like a 9% with vouchers in place. Okay. And that makes us more competitive than a lot of other cities. But those are the only two ways we do it.
Good. Thank you. That clarified that. Yes. Good.
Moving right along.
All right. Thank you.
You had another question? To me?
Two questions.
You have two questions.
Two questions.
Come on back.
All right.
Eric directs.
Okay, I'll just ask.
He's a director, so we let him direct. Okay. But you may throw the question out there. Commissioner Hurd.
Page 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at the VAS total.
Uh-huh.
And in the letter that we sent to HUD.
Uh-huh.
Regarding any 50 additional vouchers?
There are, and I found that out after we published this. So, yes,
really?
There. Next time you see this, it will be 205, not 155.
Great.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Good increase. Good. One more question.
Good catch.
Page 5.
Page 5, okay.
I really love seeing this. I didn't know that we could do something like this. At the very top, 12 people. We ended up converting
yes.
two apartments into one
yes.
to accommodate that many people.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I was really glad to see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for helping families mm-hmm. like that. Oh, I just had to say that. As I was reading it, I was like, wow, we do something like that?
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we
oh,
did.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so when they move out.
We'll put the wall back.
Yeah,
the
wall and back. They become two units again.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if you noticed, but our public housing count actually went down by one because of that. But
yeah,
went down.
Just one,
just
and it'll go back up.
On that. I was really, I just wanted to comment on that.
Good catch.
I was reading. Yeah. I was just wow, we do that. So that's it. That's all for me. All right, thanks. Yeah.
Oh, good. Good.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Commissioners, staff? No? You did good.
Okay.
You did good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Moving right on to...
We should formally open and close the public hearing.
Okay.
We have no
I don't know if you're
going to
do them both
item.
Together no. or if you're going to do them individually.
Yeah, open and close the public comment.
Because individually?
You just call it open and call it closed for the
okay.
record.
Okay. So is anybody here that wants to speak on the public comment portion? Oh, somebody's under arrest?
No, this is the next. They're getting ready for the next item. They're getting ready for the next item, not this item.
Hearing none, public comment is closed.
Great.
Okay. Moving right along to item B, public hearing and presentation on Section 8. Go ahead.
Yeah, item B is a proposed changes to the Oakland Housing Authority Section 8 Administrative Plan and the Oakland Housing Authority Public Housing Emissions and Continued Occupancy, or ACOP, policy. There are two things we've put out during this public comment period that are related to some illegal action from Bay Area Legal Aid for 5 applicants that they had. We're currently at the end of some settlement conversations with them, but what we've been able to do with them is to negotiate some changes in how we can provide our applicants the information by which they're denied prior to an informal hearing. The issue is that we used to make them come into the hearing and they could look at the documentation, but because of restrictions from the Department of Justice in the criminal checks, it was really kind of convoluted and they would have to come to the hearing to get it and they didn't have time to really prepare for the response. And Barrier Legal Aid wanted to try and find a way to give them copies of that prior to the hearing so they could come present themselves at the hearing. Michelle Hassan, our Director of Leased Housing, has been the lead in settling this and working it out in a way that the applicant can get a copy of this, and then they'll actually, the police department used to conduct the review, and it's now moving over to leased housing, who will conduct the review and suitability, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did I miss anything? Do you want to?
No, I think you hit everything on the head. I think what I'd like the commissioners to know is that there's a difference between the informal review and the informal hearing. The informal review is for applicants. The informal hearing is for program participants. And so some of the changes you'll see are that program participants have a right to an informal hearing, which is a much more stringent process. The applicants have the right to the informal review, which is once the informal review officer makes a decision, that decision is final. So those are the two differences, which are some of the changes that you'll see.
And the access to the records is fairly strictly controlled, and who can see
right.
it and who it can be released to. So we had to change some of our procedures for both the public housing ACOP side and admin side to allow how this process was going to flow and when it was going to be mailed and who was going to hear it. And that's what these changes are attempting to accommodate in a formal way. We prepared an administrative bulletin changing some of these in the interim because we don't see any harm, but we want to make it part of the formal policy, so we're putting it out. Whenever we change the admin plan or change the ACOP, we always have to put it out for public comment. And we've just chose the same time as we did the MTW plan because these are actually attachments to the plan, and we wanted to get them in this year if we could.
So the major change is that the police department will no longer be providing the record directly to the applicant. The record will be forwarded over to a non-police staff person on my staff who will then be charged with providing that record to the applicant at the time that the denial letter is mailed. So when they come to the review, they're equipped to bring additional information.
If they request a review, yeah.
Bring additional information that proves that they're not the person of the record. They could bring an attorney. So they're equipped and ready when they come to the review to state that, in fact, they don't think they should be denied from the program. And that wasn't what we were doing prior to this change.
And the reason for the third-party review?
The reason for that is that the police department cannot physically provide that record directly to the applicant. So we need to have someone on staff who can do that. We just have to bifurcate those responsibilities. So our police department are basically in compliance with the criminal history screening procedures that they must uphold, and that we can then have a staff person who will have to go through some stringent training to access criminal records, etc. It's a huge undertaking. Chief Duplexis and I are working together to assist the person with getting trained as well as provide training to the staff.
And I would say during the whole process of the last 9 months that we've been dealing with this issue, Jennifer Bell, who's been our counsel on it, has had to wade through some fairly ridiculous things to get to what we could do, and including talking to the Department of Justice and a number of other people. It's been difficult on two sides to negotiate this, and she's had to get everybody in the room and work through it. And it's not something that I think was initially thought of as being too comfortable, particularly on the CLEAT side. Is CLEAT, is it?
CLETS.
But it is allowable, and I think we are safe, and I think it also provides the documentation that our applicants need to be to give a thoughtful response if it's not them, and know how they need to go correct that record if they need to. So I think it's a much fairer way for the applicant to get its access to the information about themselves. It just turned out to be a really big issue to get it released. I was shocked. When we had these meetings, I would walk out and my head would be spinning. Yeah.
I think that the difficulty was because the way the statute was written, both the HUD statute and the state law statute were written as if the police department were a separate entity. And that's why, so the police department has special rules about what it can and can't do with releasing records, which normally, if this had been another city housing authority that didn't have its own police department, it would have been a much simpler process. But the chief and his staff are constrained by their relationship with this CLET stuff, which is totally convoluted, which is a procedure that they have in terms of releasing records. And again, it's just because they're part of the housing authority that
got it, you know, problematic, and he was afraid that if he didn't comply with these CLETS requirements, he would lose the ability to access the records. So we had to, you know, work with the Department of Justice in addition to the state and federal statutes.
So we've created a firewall, basically, between the police and the operating departments, and it moves across the firewall into the participant, and that's what this language is attempting to accomplish.
And what were we doing before?
They would go to the informal hearing. At the hearing, we would provide them with a written copy of the background to the person who we did the background in. And then we would take it at the end because it was something that they were not allowed to release. Okay. So they had the time at the hearing to review it and make an argument or case about it.
In preparation for the for the review.
Okay.
We don't have the ability to change the report or correct the report on either side, the police department side or the leased housing side. The report comes through the Department of Labor's.
The police will redact the report, however, before they give it to my staff. So the report will be redacted prior to providing it to my staff person.
It won't, for example, they
will redact juvenile records and arrest records. Only convictions will show up, which is what the rules, the HUD rules require.
Yes.
And what
we get it.
The police department gets the complete record. Then before Michelle's staff gets anything, everything related to arrests and juvenile records will be redacted. So they only see the convictions, which is what the rules are in terms of basing the denial on.
Yes. And the applicant, when they get the record, even though it's been redacted, it's still their record. They have the responsibility to destroy it and if it ends up somewhere, it's their liability.
And we will destroy the copy that we have within 30 days of our decision. So, again, we're bound to not keeping those records. We'll actually have them shredded. They're copied on do not copy paper. So we will get one record for the police department for the applicant and the other record for the authority. And once the decision has been made, we actually destroy the criminal record.
Wow, heck of a process. Okay, any other? No.
Please.
This hurt, please.
Yeah, regarding the convictions, who makes the decision to deny them?
So in terms of the conviction, the designated staff person, it will be trained to be able to make that determination. They will make that determination, and then the family will get the decision. And then they may request a review. At the review, there will be a third party who is not a party to the staff person making the decision or the family. They can then have a review with a third party, impartial third party, who may see something different, may have a different opinion about why they were denied. And then that would be the final decision that would be made.
And part of that is when the applicant comes forward with any mitigating issues they want to bring up related to any of the convictions that are presented and make any case for any changes of behavior and adjustments. And one of the things that I realized that it's easier for someone to do that with a non-officer. Mm-hmm. They're often more comfortable because they're not sitting across from an officer. So I think that it's going to make it less intimidating, I think, for some of our applicants who are in that. And one of the things that is rather not surprising is the people who request informal hearings on this to the police department, the vast majority he approves, whoever or he or she, the officer approves, because they do have mitigating reasons. They have changed their life, and they're able to talk to the officers about that. And I think that'll still be true when it goes over to leased housing. People who request the informal hearing do so because they want to make the case to us of why they should be in the program. And I'm not sure the total percentage. Last I thought it was like 60-some-odd% last month. Yeah, it was nearly 70. I track it every month to keep tabs on how they are through the chief's report, how many we did and how many were denied, how many were approved who requested hearings. And it's always in the sort of high 60s, low 70s, the percent of that are reversed at hearing. So they were first denied, and then we reversed and let them in based on hearing the entire story. Some of it could be a VAWA case where there was a victim of domestic violence occurred that resulted in arrest that was directly tied to the domestic violence, and this was the victim. But there could be other mitigating circumstances, too. So it's very important to encourage applicants who get the denial letter to go get the informal hearing.
Okay.
There are two situations, however, that are strictly prohibited, two types of convictions, registered sex offenders and people who have been convicted of manufacture of methamphetamines on federally assisted property. And those are statutory, so those people are strictly prohibited from getting into public housing or Section 8.
And it was about a year ago that the Secretary sent a letter reiterating that fact. And I've been sort of critical of that because I thought it was relatively disingenuous to say, yes, that, you know, facts often hide the truth. The fact is that is what the CFR says. Those are the two lifetime bans you can't get around. The truth is there's a whole lot of other obligations that are in the CFR that we have to do. And so it's a little deceiving to say these are the facts when you know that the next three pages say what we're supposed to be looking at when we do eligibility and what we're supposed to ensure in terms of the properties through our background screening and checks. So this is the process we have. I think that this does take a step forward in terms of allowing people to come to us and see what the basis is, see what they have to do, and also make a case to be admitted. And it is a big change in the way we do business here. I don't know anybody else who's doing it. I think we probably work, at least for the Bay Area, we're the scapegoat because we're the big one. They get us, they can now go after other housing authorities. But it's hard to release these records and to have found a way and a solution. I just want to hand it to our council for working us through that, so that we could separate it out.
Cool. Oh, one more question, please. So when we deny them, do we know how many we're denying? And when we deny them, do we help them?
So if we deny them an applicant, usually what we will do is provide them 211, Eden information and referral. They can still go to other assisted property and apply. So we do encourage people to continue to apply, also to go to our community-based organizations and see if there's transitional housing or other types of housing that are possibly available to them.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Castillo.
Concerning the relationship with Bay Area Legal Aid, are they comfortable with the final draft of this policy?
Well, it's still pending right now. We did do a presentation to them last week, and we're waiting for comments from them. Mm-hmm. Once we get those back, we'll finalize the administrative bulletin as well as any internal procedures.
But they've been involved in the talks all
yes.
the way through. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments, questions? I have one. Quite often in our hearings when our police department heard people appealing the decision that was made, we would find that they have other issues going on and they had like warrants out for their arrest pending, and our police department would just say, oh, by the way, we need to put your hands behind your back and take you out here because there's a warrant for your arrest. Is that going to impact the ability for the police to do that now that they're not doing that anymore?
I would call on Sergeant Malik. He's here to represent the chief tonight on this issue.
Okay.
The chief is out of town, unfortunately.
What's great about these is we get advance notice that the person has a warrant in the system. If it's a small warrant, someone jumping BART fare or something like that, we have the ability to cite them out. But if it's a pretty big warrant where they're wanted for grand theft, $50,000 or above, we do have to arrest. But now that the informal hearing is taking it out of our hands and into their hands, we will alert them. We'll tell them that they have a warrant out for their arrest. But I don't think that was discussed with our chief to actually just be at the meeting and show up. I mean, we're busy
outside.
Enough as is. Depending on the warrant. I mean, if it's a homicide warrant, obviously, if they're going to come to the meeting, then yeah. But I think we'd take that by case-by-case basis.
Yeah,
but
okay.
We usually exercise discretion with the smaller warrants and the ones that are less impacting on the police department.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, don't be sorry. This is your job. Commissioner Hurd.
Good for you, sir. Okay. Regarding, what was that question? I wanted to ask, the training. Mm-hmm. How are they going to be trained? What kind of training is that person going to get?
We're going to probably introduce them to the list of crimes that we're going to be looking for, a list of convictions that we're looking for. We got to, because I've been heading up the informal hearings since I've taken over the investigations mm-hmm. unit. And it's pretty simple, but it takes a little bit to recognize. Coming from a police police background, it's pretty easy for me to transition. But when it comes from a non-police status, it's going to take a little bit of training how to recognize what's a felony, what's a misdemeanor, and whatnot. So it's pretty much just how she's going to read it. What does 487 mean versus 187? Stuff like that, just distinguishing between codes and what's a serious felony conviction and what's a non-serious felony conviction.
Okay. I only ask the question because recidivism right now is 70% in the state. And one of the main things they need when they come out is housing. Mm-hmm. And the person that's going to be looking at those records, really we want them trained so that they're not discriminating against them and they give them a fair chance.
We understand that, and we also look at if there is a certain pattern that person's establishing by their criminal behavior, mm-hmm. And there's no end in sight in regards to anything that just stopped mm-hmm. right then and there, and then they started going to these rehab centers, going to job sites and stuff like that, we will take that into account, but if there's just a continuing pattern of criminal activity, then it just takes it out of our hands. We have to make that decision.
Okay.
I do want you to know that for the last 2 months, Carol, myself, and the designated staff person have been meeting, and we've been talking about, he's been talking about that thing, mm-hmm. that gray area, where you make a decision to provide someone housing who may have a record, but can display that they're in the community, volunteering in programs, that they've changed their behavior. You may have someone who's had something on their record for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years, and if they can show a pattern of trying to be a better person in the community, a better neighbor, we're looking at that. So the training is statute. It's a lot of what Paul talked about, but it's also from our chief. Common sense, you know, how do you look at each individual person and try to make the best decision? Okay. So what will happen for the first 60 days, the leased housing designee will be working with the police department, you know, in terms of this is her recommendation and then getting some feedback. They're not going to just kind of leave us alone and to flounder. We really do work closely together. So I think it'll be very successful with the support of our police department.
All right. Thank you.
Wonderful. Any other questions? Comments? Hearing none. Thank you so much for that presentation. Very well done. You answered our questions succinctly. Now we need to open it up for...
Yes, if we just we can open and close one public hearing for both items. Yeah.
That's what I asked you the first time.
For both of these.
Okay, so we're opening it up for public comment. No speaker cards, no comment, no comment. Okay, hearing closed.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. Item C.
Moving on to item C, consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to execute a contract with Town Ford Incorporated for the purchase of 6 new police vehicles in the amount of $152,273. Lieutenant Colts is here to give us a brief report on the need of vehicles at the police department. This is a bid that went out, and it's a routine purchase that is budgeted during the budget year, and these are the 6 we approved this year. Lieutenant?
Lieutenant Gerald Coates, Oakland Housing Authority. So We had 5 vehicles in our fleet that were 2003. Each had over 100,000 miles. The maintenance cost and ongoing ability to have those vehicles operate in a safe manner was deteriorating. So we started rotating those out of the fleet. These vehicles are necessary to replace those that we're losing in order to maintain a high level of public safety and our ability to respond.
I'll move the item.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any comments, questions? I have one. Lieutenant Coates.
Yes, sir.
Fords? Really? Fords?
They're American made.
Ford is still one of the few vehicle manufacturers that actually provide police vehicles. Dodge does with the Chargers. However, the maintenance costs, gas mileage, ergonomics of the vehicle are considerably less than the Fords. So.
Good answer. I really wasn't that concerned. That was just
good answers.
But I had an answer for you, sir.
Really? Okay, it's been moved. Oh, Commissioner Castillo?
I believe this is a new addition to include the funding piece stating that the amount was included in the 2011-2012 operating budget. I really appreciate that. It doesn't tell me whether there's a difference in the amount that we got it for, but I appreciate the information so much.
Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying, the difference between the budgeted amount versus the bid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we spent every dollar, is what you said.
Yeah, we can provide that. We just didn't really think
about that. No, I appreciate what's in here, but it would be cool.
Because the chief will work at spending every one of those dollars before June 30th, I can promise you.
Before it's over.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments, questions? It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Any abstentions? It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you. Item D.
Item D is approval of 6 California Public Employee Retirement CalPERS resolutions fixing the authority's contribution under the Public Employees Medical and Hospital Care Act. CalPERS now requires us to pass a resolution whenever we have a change. As you know, we've approved MOUs for the Building and Trades and Local 29 in addition to unrepresented. The reason there's 6 resolutions is we have to do one for the current employees and one for the retirees. So the retirees are a special district and the employees are a public agency. Flo Lewis, our Director of Housing, Human Resources, is here to present the item, but it's basically conforming to the actions you took at the last meeting, correct?
Yeah, and keep in mind, you do not see a resolution for Local 1021, and that will come after they settle their contracts. We will implement 29's medical increases. 1021.
Say that again, please.
Local 1021?
Yes.
There's only 6 resolutions because they're not included. It would be additional 2 resolutions that have to be implemented after they settle their contracts.
Okay. I'll move the item.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. See how kind they are to you?
Hello.
They saw you not feeling so good. So
you can tell I'm not the same old Flo today, huh? I'm in pain in my back.
Yeah, I saw that.
Risk management needs to come in. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any abstentions? Oppositions? Hearing none. It's unanimously carried.
Thank you, Commissioners. Moving on. Item E, a consideration of a resolution authorizing the Executive Director to execute the second one-year contract option term with Edrington Shermer Murphy, LLP, and Law Offices of Charles Tillman Ramsey for unlawful detainer legal services in the amount not to exceed $62,500 for each of the 12 months. For the 12-month option term. I will turn it over to Patricia Eisen, our Deputy Executive Director for Property Operations, who can introduce a couple of our dignitaries in the audience as well.
Good evening, Commissioners. Thank you, Executive Director. I also want to acknowledge that standing next to me, my colleague in arms is Shelby Aguiano, our Director of Property Operations. We figured we'd tag team since this is our first time up at the gate. Also in the audience with us are the principals from both of the 2 firms being brought before you today, Charles Ramsey of the Law Offices of Charles Ramsey and Associates and Tim Murphy of Edrington Shermer and Murphy. Both gentlemen and their firms have been with the Housing Authority for multiple years and have achieved a great impact on helping us make sure that our sites are safe through unlawful detainers and in many cases, both firms has helped us with efficiencies and cost-cutting procedures in terms of training staff, enhancing our documentation in the process that we use, and also assisting OPO, the Office of Property Operations, with lease enforcement that prevents the need to go to a full eviction and potentially a court trial by the use of stipulated agreements, as well as working toward helping us with our triage so that often people choose to move out in prevention of an eviction, which helps the Housing Authority save costs and also ultimately helps the clients as they move out not have the eviction on record and thus make it a little bit easier for them to lease at the next apartment that they're able to find. And I can also sense that Mr. Murphy and Mr. Ramsey are behind us ready to answer any questions, as they always are. They always have our back. So any questions?
No, move the item.
It's been moved and seconded. Any other comments, questions? Hearing none? So that man sat down already. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? It's unanimously carried.
I want to thank the board, but I also want to thank Tim Murphy and Charles Ramsey both for their tireless work and having to deal with me and Patricia on a daily basis through those years.
Well, since they're here, maybe they'd like to say something. Give us some advice on how we can do better.
I don't know about advice. I would like to thank you. The Housing Authority has always been a very valued client in our firm, and we enjoy working with Patricia and Eric and all of their staffs. They do a great job, and they help make our jobs easier. So thank you very much for your confidence in us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'd just like to echo what Tim had said. I also appreciate the opportunity to work with Eric and Pat, work with them, both me and Tim, for the last decade. So we feel honored and appreciate the effort and the hard work everybody puts in. I think that working with the tenant representation, Siberia Legal Aid, Eviction Defense Center, East Bay Community Law Center, mm-hmm. they've also seen the work that's gone in to make the rules and regulations clear. And as long as the clear due process is followed, I think everybody feels a lot better about the work that they're doing. And we do know that out there is a lot of respect for the Oakland Housing Authority and the processes that have been implemented. And so I think just hearing even the discussion about what's going on with the reviews and giving residents and people opportunities makes the word get out that the Oakland Housing Authority and the Housing Commission have been there to serve the community, because we're not in the business of evicting people, but we are in the business of making sure that rules and regulations are being complied with for all our families. So I just appreciate it, and thank you for the opportunity, and feel good about being able to help out.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramsey, we're aware that the press has an uncanny ability to follow you around.
Yep.
How did you ditch them today?
Well, I'm also on the school board out in West Contra Costa in Richmond, so I'm president of the school board, and we do a lot, and we work making sure that we can. And I also try to make sure that the Oakland Housing Authority, Patricia and I, have put on a forum for the charter schools one year for your residents so that the families know they have options within the schools. And I'm also now working, and Jennifer might be excited about this, with the Oakland Unified School District to bring a moot court and mock trial program to Oakland schools so that they can participate as well. We started this year in Richmond, and so we had kids from Kennedy, Richmond High, and now De Anza, working with Bolt Hall and working with the Center for Youth Development through Law. So working really hard to help Oakland youth and give them internships and opportunities. So that's what we have going on right now. So I'm working with Alice Spearman from the Oakland Unified School District and working with Jody London and also working with Chris Dodden. So we're working really hard to try to make sure that youth, especially in public housing, get additional opportunities. Yeah.
Go to the next item.
Thank you.
Come back to it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So Moses has to step out. Yes. So as a result of that, we're going to slightly modify the agenda here by delaying the next item until Moses returns, which means we will now move to recognition of people wishing to address the commission. We have no speaker cards. If there is anyone hiding out there that would like to address the commission, let us know. Hearing no one, Let's move to written communications.
Written communications. Good evening, commissioners. The monthly report is provided as always. If you have any questions on the report or anything we can clarify, please let us know now or even later after you review it. Moving on to written communications behind the second blue sheet, there are a couple of things I just want to walk through. We do have the March Resident Advisory Board Report meeting. I'm trying to include that in the actual month that occurs rather than the delay. On the back of that, you're going to see the notice of that I've accepted 50 additional VASH vouchers on behalf of VASH vouchers. We've been enormously successful at utilization of the VASH vouchers based on Michelle Hassan's hard work with the VA. It's not an easy program. It had sort of a slow start because the VA, to be honest with you, didn't really understand what they were supposed to be doing. It was just sort of something HUD did, and then they kind of had to come along. But now we have a very good relationship, I think, with that office, and we're able to lease them up. So I'm happy to accept those on behalf of the veterans of Oakland, and I'm looking forward to serving more people. There is a letter I included that was from Donald Lavoie about lobbying and a reminder letter. It was sort of, I included it because I received it, as did the chair, and I just wanted to share all those correspondence with the board. I also today, though, emailed because I recalled that this had come out, and I probably should have put it in the packet, which is an email from NARA who asked for some clarifications. It's really based on the Byrd Amendment, and what they're warning you to do is not pay any person for influencing or attempting to influence an officer or employee of any agency, member of Congress, et cetera. But the clarification that HUD provided basically is the Byrd Amendment, and you probably know all this, but I'm going to say it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, but the Byrd Amendment prohibition applies specifically to the federal actions enumerated in the statute, contracts, grants, loans, cooperative agreements, or renewals or amendments to them. It has not been and should not be read as a generic prohibition against applicable to general advocacy or informal or informational activities that do not involve a particular federal action enumerated in the statute. Right. And what they're saying there is basically when we go back to Washington and meet with somebody, it's a meeting we have with HUD, and it's not really advocating. This doesn't really apply. We're not lobbying for them. We're not a paid lobbyist. Okay?
Right.
All right, moving on. Moving on to the embarrassing letter that the seniors at Palo Vista wrote. I was very embarrassed by it, but I am very flattered that they took the time to thank the staff and the agency in this regard. It was touching to me, and I was very, very moved by it. They had a group meeting one afternoon and drafted it and then signed off on it, and I just can't tell you how much I'm grateful for them, not really just for the letter, but because they're actually just a wonderful group of people who have been so patient with us while we figured out how to do this the right way. And the moves, and they're a lot of fun to play dominoes with if you have time. And they're just a really terrific group. And I'm hoping that, and I think we may have, if you haven't gotten one yet, I think you will be getting an application off, or an invitation in the mail for the barbecue we're having just to thank them in April. It's very informal. It's just a community barbecue, and you can come see the units in the building. I would say it's right now, I think, by far our best-looking senior property. It's just really a terrific space. You get into it, it's got a green courtyard, it's got a rose garden, it's got a little atrium in the center and some barbecue areas, and the community building looks beautiful. And it's just that staff did a great job. The project's completely wrapped up. That residents are moved back. We're now releasing the vacant units that we were holding vacant for the period of time while we were doing the restoration. I think all in all, particularly William Bailey and Patricia Eisen and Jeff Menge, who really worked on the project, you know, from the word go, did a real heroic job at keeping it. It's the first time we did it, and in building and trades were terrific during the whole project in terms of working with us to resolve any issues as soon as they came up so they didn't bubble up. We were able to provide a lot of employment for a lot of Oakland people through that project, and it was meaningful, benefited work, as opposed to hiring a contractor who would have taken a profit and charges for every change order. The quality of the work, if you can see the units, and if you can come out, you'll see the quality. It's higher than I think we have anywhere, and we didn't pay more for it because we did it in-house. We were our own contractor, right? And I just want to let them know I'm all very indebted. Flo Lewis, in addition, who had to process all the employees and then furlough them recently because it was the end of the project. And,
yeah, can I just make a quick comment? Mm-hmm. I just wanted to encourage all the commissioners to drive by and look at this thing because this is really something to be proud of. This is a really well done project, and we managed it ourselves. So it really provides a chance to see what internally we're really capable of doing with regard to construction. And it's just in such a nice spot, and it feels really good that you know, it's worth looking at.
Yes. Thanks. I think everyone who was involved is real proud of it. I really do. I included Ballard Spar wrote just a basic markup of something called the House Subcommittee holds markup on Affordable Housing and Self-Sufficiency Improvement Act of 2012. I don't know what to call this. I don't think anyone in D.C. knows what to call this. You know, we had SEVRA. We have those acronyms. I'm just calling it the Section 8 or the, you know, Act that everyone's talking about. It doesn't really even, I think, have a number yet. Yeah. But it looks like it's going to go forward. So this is really one of the main points of us going back to D.C., next week is to understand what this is in our perspective. What it contains that is particularly important to us is the moving to work inclusion. It does two things. It makes current move to work agencies designation permanent.
Wow.
And that's a huge thing for us. It also attempts to expand the program. Expanding the program, there are some controversies. Other people don't really want to see it expanded because of the cost of the program. Because a lot of the agencies they fill who are MDW agencies have handled that took away tenants' entitlements. We are not considered in those groups, I would say. But I think because there's a tug and pull on both sides of the aisle, there's some support of this. But the push right now is that some people who are in more of the tenant advocates and legal advocates were opposing expanding it. What I heard on Friday when I was in D.C. is that they looks like they got everyone in the room, meaning the five people who opposed it and the five people who wanted it expanded or however the number, and they kind of hashed out a compromise. And if that compromise sticks, it looks like it'll go forward and there will be some form of an expansion. The expansion will have two tiers to it. So I haven't read the language, and the person drafting it, we know, and he hasn't read it because he hasn't written it. So that's how quick I'm telling you that, you know, we'll get it eventually. But what I hear is if the decision regarding most of this and the budget are going to be made in the next 3 weeks. And then, so it's not the same timeline as the regular budget where in the summer they're fighting about it. Really, the ship will have sailed by the middle of April. This looks like it has enough support to go through. What I really want us, our position, I think, is fairly clear. We really believe we've done a lot of good for everybody with MTW. We believe we've protected and enhanced our residents and the lives of our residents in really significant ways, and that we want to be made permanent. In terms of the expansion, it's fine for them to expand it, but should they expand it, I don't want any changes to our current entitlements. So I want to make sure that we're preserved. And that's the message that I want to go back with next week and make sure that we can get that across to as many people as we can. And as you know, we do have a meeting with Barbara Lee's office is scheduled right now for 1 o'clock on Tuesday, if you're there. And we will be getting you, Anna Gwen and Greer and I are putting together a little packet this week, and we'll have that delivered probably Thursday, do you think? Yeah, so we'll have that delivered to the people going on Thursday. It will include just a one-pager on our points. It'll include things like our annual report and some other things just to have with you for the meeting. I'll have extra copies as well. Thursday, this Thursday.
Here locally.
Yes. Yeah, we're going to get it delivered to you, and I'll bring copies, or we'll FedEx them to the hotel so I have extra copies. There, I won't get in until late on Sunday night, but we'll have them for Tuesday when you make the rounds. All right.
You were still speaking. I don't know why you even stopped.
Are you still speaking?
Oh,
no, I'm not speaking.
I have some more announcements. If we're on to announcements. I want to thank all of our staff who helped the Mayor's Summer Youth Employment Program outreach. We had three events. One was at McClyman's High School, and one was in 98 There's a Park. but the one we held at Lockwood Gardens on Thursday, I think, was by far the most outstanding one she conducted, and it was really a lot of our staff and the officers who put that together, and the turnout was amazing. I really want to hand it to all the kids. It dispelled every concept when people think that our kids just want to sit home and watch TV, because they do not. People went home, changed, put on ties, and came to the job fair. It was really quite an amazing thing to see. Cool. The reason that summer youth employment to me, and this is here and at the WIB, is such an important issue is because summer youth employment has so much more to do with actually than the job. It has to do with the experience outside of high school that gives people exposure to a social order and a way of interacting that they don't get otherwise. What happens in our neighborhoods is that the jobs that were traditionally, when I was growing up working at Taco John's, I could go get during, you know, when I was in high school, are now taken by adults. So they're not available to our children. So if we as a community, and that means OHA and everybody else, don't make room at the table for the teenagers to come get a job when they're in high school, we're actually not just denying them the wage, which a lot of them use to buy school supplies and clothes. What we're really denying them is an experience to function outside of a school social order. And high school has become kind of a really difficult thing for a lot of our youth. And I think it's really beneficial for anyone who goes gets a job at an agency to learn how to simple things like address people and engage in people that doesn't have the same social dynamic as a high school. So I remain adamantly supportive of summer youth employment for reasons that have nothing to do with the actual employment. It has to do with the way I think it changes the way teenagers can see their future and can see that whatever is going on in high school is temporary. And I think that's a really important message to get to them, and that you only get it to them by having them have the experience themselves. We're expecting some letter from HUD related to our disposition applications of the senior site in the next probably week or so. I will get that out to you as soon as I hear it. I did tell you I told attended CLOFA. While I was at CLOFA, Janet Rice also attended on the chief financial officer's committee that she sits on for CLOFA. Additionally, Patricia was in D.C. at the same time, and I was able to ditch out on the CLOFA meeting and jump the subway to go up to see her. The Department of Health and Human Services invited us to do a presentation. The Office of Women's Health was doing a workshop called Meeting the Reentry Needs of Women, Politics, Program, and Practices, and we did a housing session, which Patricia did. We're probably going to repeat it for you because it's so amazing, and I think it was just educational to put together, and I think we're probably going to share it with you in the next meeting or so. I mean, I really want to thank her. She did a great job, and it was a rough crowd because they wanted something. The other couple things I want to mention is we want to try and schedule some budget committee dates. We're going to have our next meeting on April 9th. Which will be approving these plans. I don't think we're going to need a second meeting in April if we have one on the 9th, and we could use that night at the budget committee if you would like. So let me know.
Yeah, I need to look at the...
Okay, I'm just throwing out that. That's April 23rd, Monday night. We can just do it here instead of the board meeting for the members of the budget committee.
Oh, instead of the board meeting?
Instead of the board meeting.
Well, I can certainly do that.
And then we want to try and get a date for the board retreat, whatever works for the board. We're here. The last announcement is CAHI. CAHI is now preparing an application in response to a NOFA for the project-based Section 8 contract. HUD released the NOFA late last week. We have our partner, CGI, and us that are working on a response to it. We think we'll probably have our current contract at least through October still, and I'm still thinking it's probably going to be January. And that concludes my report.
Okay. Quick question on that. CAHI, mm-hmm. Is it Northern California or is it all of California? Do they divide it? How do they do that?
They have issued, they're going to do two contracts to the same person for Northern and Southern California, which makes no sense to me.
Wow.
But we opined, and they clearly didn't think it was necessary, that whoever gets the contract for California will have a contract for Northern California and a second contract for Southern California. And they will report to the respective field offices, which is what I think is the mistake. I think they should have just done two contracts with two awards if they're going to do it that way, or one contract with one office, which would have been preferable.
Okay, here we go. Sorry.
So, Eric, did we finish both written communications here and your report regarding all of the whatevers?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Pardon? Oh, yes, go right ahead. Marlene has a question. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't see that.
Bear with me, I have a couple questions. I want to thank you for the report. I learned a lot reading it, and I know you put a lot into it, so thank you, Eric. On page 5, under Section 3 hires, I just wanted to know what will be in that report.
In terms of?
The asset management staff report.
Oh, that was actually, we put that in because of the last item that you voted for. So they would track their Section 3 hires related to John Stewart.
Okay.
So that's why it's an addition, and it came out of last month's board meeting. So we want to make sure that we stay on it, so we put it in the report.
Okay, now I'm going to move quickly. Page 7. Sheer First Ongoing Food Giveaway. Campbell Village. Hey, is that something we can do in the other places?
That's a good suggestion that we can bring up to Family and Community Partnerships.
Thank you.
If you notice the changes are coming from Anna Kadanovskaya has taken over asset management, so she's now doing a separate report just on those sites. One of the things I'd asked her to do is to include the Campbell Village Rec Center participation so that we could watch that every month.
Okay.
And that's where you're reading the...
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. And at the very bottom, the several programs are in the development phase, planned to implement later. Everything I'm reading at the bottom here, wow, this is great. Is this something we can put in the Our Voice so people can know they're coming?
We could. We're trying to do outreach.
Okay.
And I think that the targeted outreach now are the Campbell Village residents and the neighborhood surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
So that the John Stewart Company is trying to target that neighborhood to use the center because we want it to become a community center for that area. It's really the only center that exists on the west side of sort of Mandela. It's an isolated pocket of Oakland that to get services, they have to cross Mandela and go farther toward downtown. So I don't know that, I think we want to see what that community wants so that we can provide what they want. One of the agreements when we opened it is we wanted to provide a bunch of options, let people sign up and let the demand dictate what we provide.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, it's always been they were given programs and the community didn't really have as much say in this is what we want. We wanted something that will attract them in. So that's what they're trying to do.
Okay.
And these programs right now are things we're trying to get enough participation interest in to get going. And it'd be fine for other people to participate, but I really want that to be that neighborhood center. I think it's important for that community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Bear with me. I just got a few more things here. Let's see. I had a question on, what page is this? The Family Community Partnership Report, this one here. Mm-hmm. And the questions come on the very back. I was looking at the number of participants, and some of the numbers were low, and some of them were evened out. For example, I'm looking at the Build Area Local Hire Program.
Mm-hmm.
We had 100, screen 100 referred, and 45 total enrolled. So how do we work the numbers like that? I mean, why did we have a low enrollment there? Or how does that work?
I'm not sure what the question is. We had 45 enrolled.
We had 100,
and 29
we had 100
completed.
Screen.
Yeah, which is a normal attrition. So you get 100 people through, 45 people actually enroll in the program.
Uh-huh.
Out of the 45 people who enrolled, we had 29 people complete. And that's a very normal attrition, I think, in most programs.
Okay. I was just looking at it. I was wondering why the numbers were.
You start with over enrollment to meet the actual complete of your grants.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And those were my questions.
Okay.
I did have one other thing I wanted to share, and that was we did get a nice little picture and plaque from Bridge Housing thanking us for St. Joseph's, the contribution project-based Section 8. They had their grand opening. St. Joseph's is a large red brick building that's about 20 on 26th Avenue and International. And since the day I arrived in Oakland, I kept wandering around these halls saying, why aren't we doing something with this? Why aren't, is anybody buying this? Well, Bridge beat us to it, but we're part of it. And I think they did an amazing job. And I just want to let you all know that you were thanked profusely at their groundbreaking, which was pouring, or their ribbon cutting. It was pouring. It was on Tuesday. And we did come out with our resident voice. And I meant to put this out on your areas, but I'll leave them here if you want to pick one out.
Okay. Okay, so any further questions on the written? Yes, Jane.
I wanted, under page 15, there seems to be a really good increase in the home ownership department that we have. There's 27 people pre-qualified for a home loan. Those numbers have increased, so I just want to commend whatever's going on in that particular department. I happen to know Stephanie Christmas is still over it, so that's she's one of the reasons why it's doing so well. But it's really great to see four people in contract. That's not easy, you know. So I noticed that, and that's great. Thank you.
Okay, any more? All right, then moving on to go backwards to recapture item F, which is Eric Johnson's contract.
You want to start?
Or
you
want me to... the item is executive director's. Nope, it's actually. I'm sorry, I'm reading from the screen. It's item F, consideration of a resolution authorizing employment contract for Eric Johnson, executive director and CEO. Notice I added CEO and secretary. They weren't in the original contract. And I realize that's my title in some of the nonprofits, so we had to name that in the contract.
Oh, I see. Yes. I thought maybe we were changing our organizational structure here in OHA because the executive director didn't have enough.
But I started, when we were doing all the switch up of the nonprofits, I realized that I'm the CEO and I don't have the title in the contract to do it. So we added all the oversight over the nonprofits into the contract, and we also added that language. Chair, I'll turn it over to you.
Let me speak to it. You let me speak to it?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Okay. Yeah, right ahead. Yeah, so speak to this.
Okay. we have our committee that was looking at employment and all the rest of this good stuff with Mr. Eric Johnson. We had some procedures in place and evaluation, all the rest of that. We haven't done that quite yet. But we looked at the contract that was put together. I think it was well done. A couple of things we changed. And I know everybody hasn't had a chance to look at it, so we postponed it so that you can have a chance to look at it. And usually, some of the comments that's brought up, usually you want to do that in closed session because you want to tie that with something else. But I just wanted to do it in a public session and say, before we do the final vote, okay, that it looks great. Mr. Eric Johnson has not really asked for an increase in salary or anything like that, which is something that most executive directors would, first thing they would jump on is, I want a raise. Okay, he didn't ask for that. He's looking at just COLA. And it's pretty straightforward. There's not a whole lot. I don't think that's going to impact our finances, which is great. I think he's very considerate in looking at that. And I think after we complete the evaluation and all this stuff, this is going to should go into effect the 1st of May. So you had a little time. But I thought I'd throw that out there so that we can put it on the front end of the meeting so we can ratify it, which I was hoping was going to happen this one, but I figured, okay.
Oh, we're not going to do this now.
Well, we can't talk about the evaluation stuff.
You,
we can
you
do
could,
it pending.
You can also do it in closed session and come out and make an announcement, or you could do the vote now. And
well,
it depends if you need a closed session.
Well, we have to talk about it first. They haven't had a chance to see it.
Oh.
You can talk about it now, though.
No, they don't need to do it in closed session if they don't want to. You don't need to do it in closed session. You can do it now if you want
okay.
to talk in closed
well,
session.
Well, part of it has to do tied to the evaluation and what we wanted to put in the evaluation that we wanted to talk about in closed session. Okay, because that's the way the contract was reading. Yeah, we were talking about having an 18-month evaluation, and then it would go Well, the contract.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what we're doing.
Well, we haven't done the evaluation.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Supposed to do it?
Supposed to go to the contract.
Okay.
Now you guys can decide.
But I mean, could we
do that? You can decide you don't want to do that, but I thought it'd give everybody a chance to speak to them before you.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's cool.
Well, that's the reason why I was saying.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm all confused. Okay.
Okay. I think we're all there. We want to do the right process.
Okay. So the right process means we need to vote on this next time. Is that what you're saying?
We can vote on it now pending the evaluation because it's going to take you place on May the 1st.
No. The evaluation is May of next year.
Yeah, you're a year off.
You're a year off.
There's no, you've done one evaluation.
Right.
And that's during the probationary period. And my contract will currently expire on May 16th, and that is the end of it. And I've given the board notice I'm not going to renew the existing contract.
Okay.
So on the 17th, I'm either here or I'm not here.
No, you're here.
And the contract that we drafted will have annual performance evaluations that you complete going forward.
Okay. I think if you look at the contract, if I remember correctly, the one that we did, the first one, there was 3 6-month evaluations.
Really?
Yes. I'm only going by the procedure.
It's on the agenda right now for closed session, so if you want to discuss it in open session, you can, or if you want to adjourn to closed session, have a discussion, and come back into open session, you can do that.
I'm sorry. I missed that it was on closed session.
Okay.
Yeah, we kept it on closed session.
Oh, okay. So good. I didn't see that. Thank you. Yes, I think we can handle it there. That's what I was concerned about. I thought it was going to be on the front end so we could vote on it, but we can vote on it in closed session.
Well, you could have a closed session, then reconvene in open session and vote.
Okay.
I see.
Got it.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Yes.
So everybody like that idea?
Okay. Absolutely.
We're going to do that then.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Wonderful.
Cool. Then now where are we?
We're done.
Oh, now we are at... No, we're not done. We now have reports of commissioned committees. But there were none.
That's right.
So therefore, we are done. Announcement by commissioners. Do we have any?
Yeah. I've been charged with the RAB folks to always tell you guys how it went. I want to really commend Jillian Ryan for her presentation. She did an excellent job. She's not here, but please let her know. She really did an informative piece on how to facilitate a meeting. And very impressive. Really good to put our people up in front and do a little something extra. It was really good.
Good.
All right, then. No other comments, then we can adjourn to closed session.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes. Take a 5-minute break.
Do we need to take a vote in closed session?
Nice.
We want to vote on the contract for Mr. Eric Johnson.
Okay, I will move the item.
Yes.
We have to say it, I guess.
This is like a motion.
Item F is consideration of a resolution authorizing the employment contract for Eric Johnson as Executive Director and Secretary and CEO of the Oakland Housing Authority.
Okay. Item moved.
Just say and its subsidiaries.
And its future subsidiaries. Its present and future subsidiaries.
I second it.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded. I've been waiting for that second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? It's unanimously carried.
Yay,
thank you, Commissioner, so much.
New job. Okay.
Adjournment.
And we're adjourned.
Hallelujah.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you.